This is Digital Music Trends, episode 115, recorded on the 9th of January 2013. So hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends, the weekly show bringing you all the latest news in the digital music industry and available on both audio and video format on digitalmusictrends.com. So first of all, happy new year to both listeners and guests. And this week we have two new faces on the show, which is great. So let's start with Clyde Smith, who blogs about indie music business and music tech startups, as well as talking about crowdfunding on his blog crowdfundingformusicians.com. So hi Clyde, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Great, thanks for having me on the show.
That's great to have you. So, and then we have David Riley, who's a good friend and director at Good Lizard Media, which is a digital marketing and consultancy firm that has many high-profile artists among its clients, and they've done work for The Prodigy, Underworld, Ruth Manuva, and lots of other people. So hi, David, and thanks for joining me on the show. How's it going?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so let's start with the 2012 sales figures, and I want to start with the US figures first, just to have a quick look at that. And both Stuart Drudge from Music Ally, Tom Cheradar from VentureBeat, and Nathan Ingram from The Verge report on this story, which comes out of the Nielsen SoundScan and Billboard survey, which is released every, you know, the first week every January, pretty much. And they take kind of different points from each of the, you know, from this report. So on the positive, if you want to take an optimistic view, you want to look at the number of transactions for music. So those rose by 3.10% to 1,661 million. So this includes album sales, single sales, videos, and digital tracks. So that's if you're taking the optimistic track. If you're taking the not so optimistic track, then we want to look at the album sales, where the unit sales fell 4% from 331 million units to 316. So those are two things that we need to contend with: the rise in transactions, of course, a lot of more single tracks being sold, but the a lower number of sales on the albums, which are of course generating the most revenues for the industry. So first of all, how do you guys feel about this drop in sales, which is also kind of reflected in the UK figures in terms of albums? And first of all, does it have to do with the album as a format? Or does it have to do with the quality of the music that was put out in 2012, or does it have to do with streaming? Take your pick. What do you think might be the cause for that? Clyde, do you want to start?
Sure. I think. Well, it's hard to say like one why or even a group of whys.
Of course.
The format shift, I think, has been really important. I go all the way back to vinyl and cassettes, and there are plenty of times you'd buy an album for a great single, and you'd have this awful album. And I know it seems like all the albums back then were better, but not all of them were. Yeah. And I bought some that weren't that great. At the end of the day, this kind of unbundling has just really met the needs of music listeners, and everything that's gone with that is really harsh, but it's kind of just how it is to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And David, do you work with bands a lot? Do you feel like there is an emphasis from bands also to try and unbundle, or is it still very much a focus on selling units and albums for them?
A lot of the bands we work with are using, like, the album's important, but they're using it for further financial goals. So
yeah,
bundling it in with other products, using it as a calling card to then make money elsewhere.
Sure.
I was going to say, Clyde, you enjoy vinyl sales in the US are up 17.7% this year.
Yeah.
I was going to ask Clyde, do you think that's something to do with direct-to-fan as well? Because we've seen a lot of direct-to-fan introducing and using vinyl records as a way to make more money from an album for their fans.
Yeah, I mean, it's the vinyl thing's cool. It's overall, it's a really small percentage of sales, I think, even with this growth. But I've been interested in it as something that feeds audiophiles and collectors and super fans, and also just people that think vinyl's cool. And it gives bands a great extra item of merchandise. And I think also a lot of times when I talk about this stuff, it comes down to numbers and marketing and business terms, but there are a lot of people that really care about vinyl, and I think that's an important part of music.
Yeah, and they also can charge a premium price, don't they? Like, David, in your experience, usually if you sell a CD for £11-12, you can sell a vinyl for £19, so that's also an incentive for bands to keep pushing that format too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these figures don't include, the US figures don't include any streaming.
That's
how
right.
much money is being made from that.
Yeah,
I think it'd be really interesting to see that. I mean, I was looking at the Swedish music totals for 2012. Streaming's up 79.4% there. I mean, it's a huge, huge market,
yeah,
obviously, for streaming. But I just wonder how much the US are doing in terms of streaming, and is that having an impact?
Exactly.
On what's going on.
Absolutely. The Digital Music News actually put an article out just pinpointing what the rise of streaming has been. And it looks like... over the past 2 years, the streaming subscriptions have more than quadrupled. So, of course, that's going to have a huge impact on the revenues for 2012. Also, counting the fact that really Spotify didn't really exist in the U.S. market in January 2012. So I think that's going to be a huge factor in these. Although, you know, there are contrasting opinions. I know that The Verge, for example, said that the number of streaming subscribers are still too small for them to really make an impact on the overall, like, sort of behemoth huge size of the US music industry. I really fancy seeing those numbers. Maybe they're probably going to be released in February or March to understand what the impact has really been on that front. And at the same time, you look at the US, and that's the situation there, of course. In the UK, it's the same, more of the same, although the drop in album sales actually was bigger. So the digital and physical album sales together in 2012 dropped by about 11.2% to 100.5 million units. The singles are doing really well, growing every year. But the real big figure for the UK is a streaming one that we don't have for the US. And the fact is that in the UK, there were 3.7 billion streams in 2012, according to the BPI and official charts company data, which is crazy. It's an incredible figure. So my question at this point is, in the UK, we seem to have a bit of a split personality disorder when it comes to this, to streaming album purchases, because if we look at the figures, 69.1% of total sales are still CDs in the UK, but still you have 3.7 billion tracks streamed. So there seems to be this huge split between a percentage of the population, which is the vast majority, that still buys physical CDs, and a much smaller percentage of people who are more digitally advanced, if you will, that stream a huge amount of tracks each. So how do you think that gap might be bridged, and do you reckon that something like Tesco integrating We7 into Blinkbox might work towards mainstreaming the streaming, which is a bit of a pun, but it was unintended. David?
My kind of comment is this, although there's 3.7 billion tracks streamed, that's only the ones that we've been able to measure and financially measure. Now, outside of that, the streaming market is many times over bigger.
Yeah.
So it says 140 per household. It'd be interesting. On average, the average household in the UK last year bought 1.6 albums.
Yeah.
And if we're saying that 140 streams per household a year, if those people who bought an album played it 10 times or so, we're looking about the same sort of figures for people's consumption.
Yeah.
I think what will make the biggest difference is deals like Tesco's, but streaming on services like Love Film and Inter, Xbox, etc.
Yeah.
And having these services available across multi-platforms, so Spotify on across all services, and having a way for people to have a centralized way to stream whatever they want. We're going to talk about a little bit later about Spotify taking off its download mechanic from its stores.
Yeah,
and I think that's kind of symptomatic. If people can enjoy their music on any platform that they own with a streaming service, then that's going to make a massive difference to actual individual downloads of specific MP3s.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And Clyde, how do you reckon? It's the same question for the US. How do you reckon you can really get streaming to the mainstream? It's a question we've been trying to face many times on the show, and I think every time we see figures of this kind that pinpoint the still massive presence of physical, it keeps coming up.
It's going to happen piece by piece. I mean, I hadn't heard about the Tesco promotion, whatever's happening with Tesco, but I think that's a national grocery chain.
Yeah, that's UK. Right. They purchased a streaming service that was, I guess, the equivalent of a US MOG type service. And so, with a view to integrate that possibly into a wider service that they're gonna introduce.
They haven't started marketing that yet.
No, not quite. They have a service as a video service. It's called Blinkbox. But as far as I know, they kind of hinted at the fact that this is going to be integrated into with the audio offering, but they haven't done it yet. So we're going to yet have to see how they're going to market that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it's brought out through the grocery store, that just seemed like a mass market play right there. I think I know we're going to talk, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I know we're going to talk about Led Zeppelin streaming, and I think one writer remarked that this might help mainstream streaming, and that I don't know. It's hard for me to think of anyone at this point, anyone act, being the tipping point. And in terms of their market, I think the people that are probably in Led Zeppelin's market already have had iconic artists start streaming. So I think things like grocery stores and kind of unsexy stuff is what's going to break it through, as opposed to hooking up with cool people or trendsetters or any of that kind of thing.
Sure. And there's another question as well that is more related to the US market, where there's a service like, for example, Move, that is offered with the Cricket network. So if you get an Android phone via Cricket, then you get the Move music streaming service with that. And that's a huge part as well of the growth of streaming in the US. And what I wonder is whether that's going to be the driver for the growth of streaming as a mainstream model. Because it's a passive way to engage with streaming. You buy the phone, you get a streaming service, or whether Spotify has a lot of room to grow as an active act of going onto Spotify, getting the free player, and then deciding that it's good enough that you want to subscribe to it. So that there's kind of a battle between those two ways of getting to the streaming music, and whether an active act of actually deciding to subscribe or whether you just get free music with your phone is going to win in the end, right?
I think there's two different markets you're looking at. With people that want to have the latest thing, want to have friends, etc., that they're on a new service, finding a new way to share. And there's people that will just accept that they can play 10 tracks when they walk around the shopping center. Those are kind of two different markets.
Yeah.
And I think the one big factor in that will be how much social sharing there will be on the streaming platforms themselves.
Yeah.
You're going to essentially search out the ones where all of your friends are. And I think that's going to be the biggest determining factor.
Yeah.
In whether people search it out or whether they accept what they're given.
Yeah, absolutely. Claudia, have you had another point?
I was thinking in terms of the mainstreaming. Other thing that could happen is Apple could launch a streaming service,
yeah,
and that would just change. That would change the game in a lot of ways. Whether that would be good for music business, I don't know, but it would certainly. I think it'd be good if it mainstreamed it and helped us move forward with this whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Let's talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess the problem Apple have got is if they bring in a streaming service, and over the last 10 years, 6 years, people have been purchasing tracks in order to make their collection. If they bring in a streaming service that says, well, actually, that collection means nothing now because you can just get it for free anyway now. I think that's going to be, I think there will be a little bit of tension in them bringing that service in. Well, I could see that being a problem.
Yeah, and I can also see like there being a huge headache as far as the actual deal making is concerned, because now the labels have, you know, a stake in Spotify, for example. You know, they're making a decent amount of money per track. They negotiate their own rates and all that. If Apple comes in, usually with their sort of, you know, blanket proposition, we're going to pay you X for each stream, I don't see a reason why the labels should be persuaded to go for it, unless there is really a huge incentive for them to do so at this point.
But that's true.
Yeah. In any case, let's move on to quickly talk about Led Zeppelin, because we're talking about streaming. So, I mean, you wonder whether it's the national story or not. You know, every time we talk about a new band joining or thinking about, it's not even joining, it's thinking about joining a streaming service. But I guess, you know, it is a story, because the question is whether the addition of bands like Led Zeppelin, like, you know, Metallica last year, will bring about, you know, will convince people that are kind of on the fence to actually join the service. And the other point is that a band like Led Zeppelin right now can get really great, probably really great advances from whichever service they choose to go with. They can get really great rates on the streams. And it's sort of like a Wild West. If you're a band that big, you can probably make your own bet. So what I'm wondering is why there aren't more bands like, you know, for example, Pink Floyd, the Eagles, the Beatles, AC/DC are still outside of streaming services. Even Peter Gabriel is outside of Spotify. You know, they're losing out on money. They're losing out on being discovered by younger fans. Their catalog sales can't be that huge anymore. I mean, of course, for the Beatles and, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, they still sold, Led Zeppelin, I think, sold almost 1 million records in 2012 in the US. So they're still selling huge amounts of records, but to a different demographic, I think, than the people that would actually stream their music. So I don't think they would be losing any money by being on streaming services. What do you think is holding them back? Do you think it's older management that is advising them not to be on there? Are they just scared of being on streaming services? Dave?
I really couldn't say, although it's funny how, not to give you more time, how age always comes up as the reason that people aren't doing something.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily age. Sometimes at the end of the day, the artist has to make the deal that's best for the artist. So yeah, it's just like Nine Inch Nails, when suddenly Trent Reznor and company were in his band were doing a label deal, people acted like they were betraying DIY principles, but it's not really like that. Everybody has to make a deal, but
yeah,
I think David might have a better picture on that than I would.
So
I honestly don't know why these bands are not doing streaming deals. I mean, I guess the major reason is that they don't have to be.
Yeah.
They don't need to, and they're in the fortunate position of being able to take their time.
Yeah.
And I mean, the one reason I guess would be is if they can, as you say, hold on for better deals, better per streaming rates, and better advances. Then in the long term, if we look at streaming as a longer term model, they're going to do very well out of keeping out for a little bit.
Yeah.
The one thing they have, you know, older bands that are still going, like Metallica, Prodigy, etc., they have enough impetus to be in there because they're still playing, they're still putting records out, they still to get to the younger fans, which the older bands don't do. But I think it's a shame. It's a shame for streaming that those artists aren't on it. Kind of the lineage between the new artists that are on there and the old artists would be amazing for the streaming services to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
And plus, it would put pay to the companies that make their living by creating cover versions and karaoke versions of tracks that people actually want to listen to.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone will miss this kind of if the artists actually put their music on there properly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, you know, not only they are losing out on streaming revenue, but they are giving that revenue to somebody else because people are still going to search for those tracks. And even if they're not happy with whatever cover is on there, if they want to listen to the tune, they're going to either stay on there or go on YouTube and find the track anyway. So it doesn't make much sense to me. I guess, you know, as you said, David, these bands don't need the revenue from streaming. But at the same time, I think if somebody went to them and actually managed to break down what their projected losses were, picking a comparable act that is making X amount of money off Spotify. Of course, all these figures are private and nobody knows who is who's making what unless they actually publicly admit to it. I think that would be a different conversation if you could show a band, you know, say, you know, you're losing out on $2 million a year because they're not on Spotify. That would be interesting, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I just wanted to quickly go on to Spotify now, and we go back to the 2012 debate and the role of downloads and the role of streaming, because Spotify has dropped their music download service in Europe. Of course, Clyde, you probably never saw that because in the US it was never available. So you can
never realized it was even. Sorry to interrupt. I never realized it was even available.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an interesting thing for us in Europe because nobody really knows what the figures were. You know, initially they were going via 7Digital, and afterwards they actually struck out on their own and they have their own service now that they provide. But nobody really knows what the figures were on the downloads. And I would imagine that a lot of music executives are probably pretty annoyed that they decided to just yank this feature out because they were hoping that there would be some conversion between the streams and people that actually still like to have their music on their hard drive and keep it there. So I don't know. And also there were some problems in terms of the actual interface because it wasn't great. You know, the way that you purchase the tracks, it was a little bit complicated. It wasn't straightforward. And Spotify actually told TechCrunch something along the lines of, we recently updated Spotify to simplify the service, pave the way for new features. In-app purchases aren't part of this update, but we're not ruling out their return. So that's an interesting way to look at it. It almost sounds like they didn't have the best system in place that they could have to sell music, so they just took it out to see what happened and with maybe a view to reintroduce it. I mean, David, on your side, do you think it's a loss for artists? Have you heard any rumblings of people saying, well, we wish that feature had stayed in?
Not at all, no. I don't think the value was particularly there. What would be extremely valuable if they're going to take that out is putting in merch purchase links.
Yeah,
that would make an absolutely gigantic difference, and would make a lot more money for artists.
Yeah, do you think there's that one player that can provide that?
There's ways to do it. We've seen it with YouTube, with other partners where if they work with someone, you know, like Topspin, for example, or a multiple of your different files, like Reverb Nation or whoever else, and actually get these. It's a very simple mechanic. I mean, they could do it simply as artists having a login like you used to have with Last.fm.
Yeah.
We have Last.fm, where you could go in and put an image and a link in. And you know, it'd be something as simple as that for artists, or maybe a closer integration. But that would make the biggest difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not totally out of the question in the sense that Spotify is moving in the direction of trying to have tighter links with the artists directly. So it would make sense for them to do something along these lines, especially from the sounds of the latest announcement that they had. Clyde, do you think like that there's a play here for Spotify to help artists in ways that are, because at the moment, you know, they don't help artists other than providing the streams, you know, that it's a discovery tool. There's no added bonus on there for artists other than making a little bit of money off the streams if they're not, unless they're huge artists, and then they can make quite a bit of money off that. What's your take on Spotify taking a role that is a little bit bigger than just a streaming service?
Well, I mean, I think I was thinking about that because some services will add music downloads and then publicize them as a way they're helping the artist.
Yeah.
I think Grooveshark may have done that, but, you know, it's the kind of thing that legitimate and quasi-legitimate companies will do to show, you know, as a signifier to artists, even if there aren't that many sales. In a way, the best thing Spotify could do is build the strongest business they can so that in the long run, they can get the most money to copyright holders.
Yeah.
And so that's one side of it. And they're a big corporation. You know, it's at their, once you get that big, something has to make a lot of money to really justify its existence.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, which is always, it's so different than smaller businesses. But I think the merchandise idea is great because everybody knows how to go to iTunes and download a song and buy it if they want it. So, but merch is a whole area that hasn't really been brought online fully.
Yeah.
Different people are coming at it, but I think that that could be a big thing if they chose to do that. It would certainly, I think for a lot of artists, it would really be seen as a positive move to help them in a way that selling downloads wouldn't be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I wanted to tie this conversation, actually, because it makes sense to your sort of thoughts on crowdfunding as well, because and David, I'm sure, has got a lot of thoughts on crowdfunding because you deal with quite a few unsigned bands as well in your time. And the way that crowdfunding is branching out from being something that is necessarily tied to a Kickstarter or you know, a company that is just focused on crowdfunding, but there are other companies that are actually looking at that space as something that they can expand into. So, for example, Songkick launching their beta of Detour, which takes them away from the from what was their core role as just an information provider and sort of ticket alert service, and makes them become something more, almost like a promoter in themselves. So, do you reckon that crowdfunding and merchandise, which go often hand in hand in the way that the rewards are structured, are something that is appetizing for tech companies to expand into, even though it's not necessarily their core business? David?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should separate out at this stage merchandise and crowdfunding.
Yeah.
And so the two major differences and what makes crowdfunding so appealing is that with merchandise, with especially with upcoming artists, is a big financial outlay to begin with. Like you spend out and then you recoup. And the difference with crowdfunding is that you come up with a concept, you get the money, and then you get the money beforehand, basically.
Yeah.
Crowdfunding is only going to work if two things happen. One, the artist build actual fan bases. You know. Yeah. Talking about actual fans, people that are engaged, etc. That's the one side that's gonna keep going. The second side is good customer experiences.
Yeah.
It only takes one band or two bands, one band actually that you know or you invested in, or you put money into, that does it badly. To create a really bad experience for the whole thing. It's a business that relies on goodwill from customers. Fans of music. So those two sides are extremely important. So if people are coming in to look at the space, they need to see how realistically they can provide experience for the customer, and maybe not over the experience for the artists themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And Clyde, what's your take? I mean, I kind of put them in the same sentence just because sometimes artists do give away merchandise as part of the crowdfunded experience, but that's of course necessarily a minority of artists, and most of them just want the crowdfunding to work for their project or for their album release. So Clyde, you've done a lot of work on crowdfunding. How do you think that could be appetizing for different companies to actually look at in terms of model?
Oh, in terms of like the way Songkick did with the events funding.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it would have to be cases where it's strongly tied into what they do in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it's a little weird because you're basically talking about a system of funding or financing, and that's not something that, say, somebody like Songkick would normally be involved with.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, Who knew Amazon was going to be one day delivering groceries to my house? I mean,
yeah,
because they start off as a bookstore. So a lot of weird things happen on the web that didn't traditionally happen offline. You know, you look at somebody like CD Baby and their group of services for artists. You could see them maybe looking at something like album crowdfunding. I could see that happen. Now, whether, you know, all these companies are private, we haven't really been seeing any real behind-the-scenes figures yet.
Yeah.
And that's what's – that really – those are the kinds of things that are really – you'd have to see that. And I don't really have that kind of information. I haven't pursued that. So that would be a question they'd have to look at. It might not actually be a good thing for any of those companies to get into at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And Clyde, you called, you know, sort of 2012, 2013, you know, the years where really crowdfunding becomes a big thing for musicians. At the same time, in a few weeks ago, I challenged that notion just because we're looking at the figures of how much money was raised on crowdfunding versus how much money was invested by labels in their A&R departments. And the proportion was literally like, you know, maybe like a 1% or 0.5 was what was the total crowdfunded money for music last year versus what was invested by labels as an A&R enterprise. So do you think there's a lot of room to grow for crowdfunding, or is it going to still remain a relatively niche part of the business that is not really going to challenge properly the label model?
Well, actually, labels are doing things with crowdfunding, and it's not something a label can't get into.
Yeah.
There's some really huge, I want to say B.B. King, they just did a crowdfunding thing on Pledge Music for an album that the company was going to put out anyway. It's not like, you've got to have this money or this music will never see the light of day. So that's actually already happening, and probably more than any of us realize, because we always focus. The exciting stories are these indie bands that have this powerful relationship with a fan base who say, we need this. And the fans go, we're going to give you all this and even more, you know?
Yeah.
And that's been a powerful thing.
Yeah.
So, but that's an artist. That's a relationship an artist on labels certainly have too, is strong relationships with fans. So
yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a challenge to the labels. It will probably end up helping some labels in the long run.
Yeah, yeah. David, what's your take on crowdfunding and label investment? Because I guess, you know, it's sort of, in theory, it's a challenge to it. On the other side, you could almost see it as a help, because it could take the role of some smaller indie labels in helping, you know, smaller artists that do have a fan base but don't have the resources to be signed or to get to that level where they can get picked up by a label in a further stage. How do you see that working out?
So there's companies, a good example is Essential Music, Cooking Vinyl. They've taken up the option on Amanda Palmer's record,
yeah.
And a few crowdfunding funded projects. The Enemy was crowdfunded. And what's kind of missing at this level is that the crowdfunding is one where you can obviously get to your fans, produce the record, sell it back to them, make the money. There's always going to be this need to get outside of that. If it's going to be a project for growth, yeah. Which for some artists it isn't. Some, you know, a 90s indie band, they're never going to get any bigger. If they realize that, then they could just monetize what they have and keep it going. That's fine. But
yeah.
For newer artists, it's about using that money with a company that can then help them attain more fans with it.
Yeah.
Now, whether that's a record label who put it through the motions and get distribution, retail promotion, and organize everything. That's maybe not a record label, but a promotions company that just do take that budget and spend it on TV ads and appearances and whatever else they want to do. There's two ways of using that money. But for developing your artists, the one problem that up-and-coming artists have is, this is a sweeping statement, but a lack of knowledge and organization. So that's what small labels basically provide them, is the foothold to do that. And the small labels don't require, I think of some really good ones in the UK, Big Scary Monsters being a really good example of one that take up-and-coming artists to put structure in it. And the way they make the money is by those artists having really dedicated fans that will pre-order and then sell. For them, their crowdfunding, I guess, would be pre-order.
Yeah.
When we talk about crowdfunding, it's basically, I don't know if Clive would agree or disagree with this, that crowdfunding is essentially a longer period of pre-order.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, yeah, that's a big part of the dynamic.
Yeah. That's an interesting dynamic there, because it's a pre-order, but it gives fans a chance to become more personally involved with the release. So that makes the pre-order more worthwhile than just going on iTunes and pre-ordering something.
Yeah,
I mean, it ties into this this idea of wanting to support an artist you care about. So there's, it's not a donation, but when you look at the different kind of tiered rewards, it's not just a pre-sale either. It's interesting. I mean, I think that's kind of part of the power is it brings together some different elements. But, you know, Dave was talking about fans beyond your immediate crowdfunding supporters. One of the reasons I like Pledge Music is that they don't use the term crowdfunding, but I think of them as a crowdfund platform.
Yeah.
But they set it in the context of an overall album campaign. And even though that doesn't inherently include, I mean, it will ultimately there'll be outreach beyond their supporters. There's this, more of this sense of this ongoing thing. You don't just get a chunk of money and then go off and do your thing and come back. There's a continuing contact with the supporters, and after you've reached your goal. So that's one of the reasons I like them as a model for doing this. They've done some really strong stuff. Plus, they're partnering with a lot of other companies that provide services to artists.
Yeah.
And that's exciting because having all these separate services would just drive you up the wall after a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I agree with Clyde. I mean... if we call it crowdfunding, but this kind of this idea, the concept is maturing, and the way people both implement it, the way they see it. I mean, originally it was a few people doing it, and it was a cash cow. It's like we'll do this, we'll get a load of cash, and it'll be great. I think you see as it matures, there's two things that happen. One, the services are getting better. And also the customers are getting used to it, and they're being asked by more of their favorite artists to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So the sophistication and the delivery is going to have to and is maturing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were just some figures released by Kickstarter yesterday. They sent a big sort of slideshow that is actually quite pretty and has some of the highlights for Kickstarter of 2012. And they talked about the fact that music has the most successfully funded projects on Kickstarter, which is over 5,000 projects out of 9,086 that were submitted. So it's almost, it's more than one in two projects that go into Kickstarter for music that actually reach their goals, which is pretty great, really. It's not a bad ratio, over 50%. But of course, musicians are quite sparing in the way that they ask for money on some of these projects. So they, you know, they might only want, you know, $2,000-$4,000 to finance the recording, which is all they really need to get things going. And again, that's empowering for them because they can reach the goal. They're not asking for $1 million like Amanda Palmer. They're asking for a lot less.
Although there's some people that ask for very little and they don't get that either.
Well, of course, yeah.
You know, there's Well, one thing I'll throw out there, Gino Launch and Release is a new blog that's they're analyzing Kickstarter campaigns. It's pretty interesting.
Okay.
And one thing they've been doing is looking at smaller campaigns for artists that don't have a fan base yet.
Yeah.
And it seems like kind of in the under $10,000 range, there have been some real big success stories for people raising friends and family and their immediate community. I think that's kind of a cool thing, too. It seems to be working for people at each stage of development. And that's important for it to, you know, become just a normal. I think it's becoming just a normal thing.
Yeah.
Me it is, but soon it will be to everyone.
All right. Well, I wanted to finish by talking a little bit about sort of musicians' music strategies for 2013, because both Clyde and David have written articles on sort of what people should be doing for 2013, what the questions they need to ask themselves are, and what the things that they can do to enhance their presence, their online presence are. So, David, starting with your article, which was more like broad in looking at all the different aspects for an artist's career, what are your thoughts on sort of, you know, the question that you put in the blog are absolutely relevant, but how hard is it for an artist to actually answer and understand what their aim is? Because that's the first part of the puzzle, isn't it? Is for an artist to really understand, you know, how many tracks do I need to record this year? How many fans do I want to reach out to? And that's the first level. You know, what's your history, and what's your take on how artists get to that point where they know what they're going to do? Because I think that's what most people that I know that make music sort of independently are struggling with, is to set goals that make sense for them, because they don't know how to set the goals for themselves.
Well, exactly. I mean, just my experience, I was in bands from 16 till old enough to know better, to about 22.
Yeah.
And bands that work with, like, unsigned bands, actually, the biggest problem is choice paralysis.
Yeah.
So there's so many things they can do. There's so many opportunities or ways of doing things, that services, gigs, just ideas. You've got five people in a band, you get five different sets of ideas, etc.
Yeah.
And what I wrote the blog for Association of Independent Music's site, and it wasn't really to provide any answers,
yeah,
but to start structuring questions that lead to results. Especially like the era doing in terms of social media and digital, we're still very much the artists we deal with and Uprise are very much stuck to this idea of Facebook numbers and Twitter numbers and these goals that essentially deliver them nothing.
Yeah.
What I want to look at with that is to properly answer is to go back before the web was this important, etc. The way when I was 16 and wearing bands the way we judged how well we're doing was whether the promoter in Newcastle had heard of us, and if we were getting more than our five mates down to our low gig. That was kind of, we were starting to see mates bring friends, or these five people that came last and they came back with friends.
Yeah.
That's the way we judge how well we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we went to play a gig out of town, when we came back, there were more people there. That's real growth. That's an artist in the ascendancy. And what I think artists really need to do, if you're looking for a goal this year, is to understand whether you're growing or you're inflating. I think that's the biggest question I was trying to kind of get out of people, and get artists to actually put goals on it. Say, I asked them, how many tracks are we going to make? Why are we going to make it? And how much money do you want to spend on it? How many gigs are you going to play? And how are you going to analyze? I suggested analyzing your digital social media work in terms of how many people replied to comments, how many people added to you on Twitter, how many people open an email every month, rather than looking at the big figures and looking at the figures that actually show that someone cares.
Yeah, sure. It's all about engagement. It's not about how many people you have following you or liking you on Facebook is about how many people are actually talking about you on Facebook or.
It's quantifying engagement as well. Last year, a lot of conferences were all talking about engagement, and engagement is the next big thing. Engagement's really important. But I swear, half the people that actually sat and watched that came away and thought, yeah, engagement. So I post on Facebook. I post something funny. I post something funny on Facebook. But not actually thinking any deeper into what engagement should be and what it means.
That's right. That's right. And Clyde, you posted a interesting article as well on how to fine tune your online presence, along the lines of, choosing the right services and finding different platforms to bring people back onto your home base, which should be really your homepage and your website. What do you think are the most important steps for an independent artist to take if they want to enhance their time, the time they spend on these services, and also the as David was saying, finding this weird magic formula for actually engaging people rather than just spewing stuff at them.
I like the engagement thing because what I found, I also found this in academic settings, is that once a term gets popular, no one's ever willing to ask, well, what does that really mean? And if you do ask, about half the time you'll get a answer, and you can tell it's not that the person doesn't really know what that means, the answer they're giving you. And I think I guess discovery is maybe the term like that right now. That's the one I'm getting beaten over the head with. But I think both David's piece, which got me thinking about the idea of that's big right now, startups called One Single Metric or One Metric That Matters, is about instead of using these vanity metrics like Facebook followers or whatever, you choose something that really indicates real growth, meaningful growth. You figure out a way to quantify it, to track it, and that becomes the key focus. You stop getting scattered out all over these other things. I think David's example of you do a gig, your friends show up, you do another gig, their friends show up. Being able to just watch your audience grow is that's a powerful metric right there that means something. And what I was doing, I think too, with David, he was kind of stepping back, saying, that's what we do this time of year. We all step back. So part of what I was saying is just it's important for artists to, on the one hand, make sure you're where your fans are. I mean, that's why you're out on social networks and here, there, everywhere on the web. But on the other hand, this is a good time to step back, look at for example, your social media network involvement and go, what did I really accomplish last year by being on Facebook an hour a day? And maybe not being on Facebook would be a better move. I mean, personally, right now, I'm doing the not being on Facebook thing, and it's actually feels really good. I'm getting a lot more work done. And because, at the end of the day, like I write a lot about social media marketing. I tend to encourage people to check out the new things, to be on, have a presence on these places. But at the end of the day, each artist has to decide for themselves, is this working for me? You might find some weird little niche network that gives you a much bigger return on that time because there's not a lot of noise getting in the way. So that's a lot of what I was trying to get at.
Absolutely. Of course, it might make sense for somebody to develop and spend most of their time on SoundCloud commenting on other people's tracks rather than trying to get fans on Facebook depending on what their music is and what they do. So for sure, like the picking a platform and sticking with it is definitely good advice anytime, really. All right, well, I think we are getting to the end of the show. I wanted to ask you guys if there's anything you wanted to plug or any project that you wanted to talk about that you're working on. If not, just shout out your website and Twitter handle, and then I'll add those to the end show notes as well. Clyde?
Gosh, I wish I had something to plug. I'm kind of figuring all that out right now, but you can find my music industry writing at pipebomb.com.
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter at Flux Research, FLUX Research, and I try to stick to music industry stuff there. And from there, you can find my blog on crowdfunding, and I'm doing some stuff with dance videos.
Great.
Hopefully, I'll have an announcement on that soon.
Great. Awesome. David?
I've just got a few things to mention for now. just to mention, I'm at David Riley on Twitter.
Yeah.
And obviously, Good Loser Media is my company. And also check out another company called Signature Brew.
Yeah.
Which is completely separate to this, but we make beers with bands and musicians.
Yeah, and it's awesome.
That's
beer.
Signature Brew.
Oh, that's
thanks. Yeah, that's signaturebrew.co.uk.
Guys, that's so cool. That's a totally cool project.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, there was a post about it on Hypebar. Yeah, someone.
That was me. That was I wrote that.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
You see? And it all joins together.
Yeah, it's your show.
Great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And I'd like to thank the audience as well. That's all for this week. Please make sure you visit digitalmusictrends.com and twitter.com/digitalmusictrends for updates on the show. You can also subscribe via all the usual channels, including iTunes, any podcatcher, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and more. And you can write to digitalmusictrends@gmail.com with any comments. So feel free to share the podcast reposts on SoundCloud if you enjoyed it. Have a great week, and till next time.